hello, it's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today I'm here with Mr. Chris Silvers. Chris, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Jake?
Doing very well. Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review, all the things. It really helps me out. Appreciate that. Thanks in advance. Chris, tell us about how you got started in cybersecurity and where you are today.
Well, Jacob, like a lot of people, I didn't intend to get into cybersecurity. It just really fell into my lap. I was working at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta and kind of finishing up a project and kind of looking for some direction, looking around, and the information security department was looking for people. This was back in the late 90s, I think before security was cool, if you will. And so they took me on. I didn't really have any qualifications, but once I got into it, I got a few projects that I sort of took a little different perspective on, I guess, and really just got into it and started studying and staying up late at nights and weekends and just learning this whole security thing. And just it became almost like a life passion for me. Mm-hmm. And that was 25 years ago. So apparently it's worked out pretty well.
That's awesome. What do you do today?
After being in corporate security for a little while, getting into consulting, and then realizing that the consultant was the product, I decided to start my own business. So about 10 years ago, started a company called CG Silvers Consulting, where we do penetration testing, we do security education, we focus on social engineering, especially with the penetration testing end. But we also do governance, risk, and compliance, PCI, HIPAA, CMMC, the new CISL. Right.
Right. And I hear you have a pretty interesting story about getting a DEF CON black badge. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So most people that know me in the industry kind of know me for social engineering. I've been doing social engineering pretty much my whole career, but it just wasn't really a focus until there was a contest at DEF CON. Gosh, I think it started maybe around DEF CON 18 or 19, something like that, called the Social Engineering Capture the Flag Contest. So competed a couple years and kind of got a little better and better at it. And then finally was fortunate enough to win one year. So if you're not familiar with the contest itself, basically there are two phases of it. At phase one, you're assigned a company and this company doesn't know that anything is going on. And you perform open source intelligence on that company. You're given a list of flags, pieces of information that you're supposed to try to find out. You can't contact the company directly, anything like that. It's got to be totally, you know, pretty much internet-based. So you go through that and you produce a report, and then that report is scored. So it has to be professionally presented. And the reporting is really important. That's one of the things that the contest really wanted to stress. But then the exciting part and the people who watch the competition really enjoy is phase two, where they put you in this plexiglass booth, right, in front mm-hmm. of the audience. And you got headset on and all that stuff. And you make calls into the company from information that you've discovered during phase one, right? So you're discovering phone numbers of people who will likely answer the phone, that type of thing. So you get in the booth and you make your phone calls and you're trying to gather the exact same flags, right? So phase one can certainly help phase two, because if you already know the answer, it's really easy to pull it out of somebody. But you come up with a pretext and you do that. And I was fortunate enough, the year that I won, this particular young lady that I called or who answered the phone, she had a very unique name. And it was a very pretty name as well. And so I sincerely, when she said her name, I had her repeat it. And I said, well, that's a very unique name. And as soon as I said that, she gave a little giggle. She was like, oh. And I thought to myself, okay, this call is going to go well. All right. We have instantly connected and she's going to give me a lot of information. And sure enough, she did. And it was just a very pleasurable call. And I pulled a lot of information out of her. And in fact, I had offered her during the call, I offered her like a gift certificate or something like that. And by the end of the call, she was thanking me, right? So wow. As soon as the call ended, the audience just exploded. I mean, everybody stood up and they were clapping. And I just, man, I get chills now thinking about it. I mean, the black badge is great and everything, but that moment will definitely live in my memory forever. I mean, it was amazing.
Wow. That is amazing. There was a presentation from an FBI agent on this type of thing. Mm-hmm. And he said that if you start feeling good about yourself when the person is talking to you, be really concerned. What are they trying to get?
Yeah, that's absolutely. Someone who is trying to create rapport with you, if they seem more interested in you than more interested in sharing about themselves, then that's unnatural. Mm. And it's interesting because scammers have developed that skill set to do that. Politicians do it all the time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they, car salesmen, they do it all the time. They act like you are the most interesting person in the world. It always reminds me of something my father used to tell me. He used to tell me, he said, Chris, you are absolutely unique, just like everyone else. So you have to have a bit of humility to thwart these social engineering attacks.
For sure. That's very true. Going into social engineering, I know there's a lot of different tools out there that the bad guys are using. And even as you said, from a penetration testing standpoint, the good guys are using as well. Can you talk to us about some of those?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm doing a social engineering gig this week, and it's a good illustration of the fact that tools change. So not only once you find a good tool that you like, you need to keep looking at different tools as well. So one of my favorite tools is a tool called Spoof Card. And basically, it's a caller ID spoofing service. Now, it still works perfectly fine for most, for like 80 to 90% of my social engineering calls. What it allows you to do is it changes your caller ID display so that when you're calling someone, what displays on their phone is a different phone number. Now, a lot of telemarketers use it. It is legal in the United States to spoof your caller ID, right? But there's a couple of things that I had a problem with this week with it. I was calling an international client and I was wanting to spoof phone numbers from their country, right? And when I did, the call wouldn't connect properly, right? So I had to go looking for another solution for that. They used to also have a service where you could perform three-way calling. Now, I won't get into what I use three-way calling for, because that we could probably do a whole podcast on that. But the point being, that feature has disappeared from Spoof Card. So I had to go find some other ones. So another couple of solutions that I've come across, another one is called Spoof Box. Works great. It's a little expensive because these services do charge a little bit of money. And the latest tool that I've found that works really well is called Open Phone. Are you familiar with Burner? It's been around a long time. It's an app.
Sure.
So Burner basically allows you to just purchase a phone number for yourself. And when you call someone from the Burner app, it's basically caller ID spoofing in a sense, but it's a real phone number. You can actually receive calls as well. Open Phone is the same way, and it's more business oriented, right? Mm-hmm. So it has automatic call recording. It even has AI call transcription, which is really nice feature for a social engineering, because that practically fills out my report for me, right? Yeah. I mean, I can get a transcript of a call and kind of highlight areas where the person answered this and that represents risk to the organization, et cetera. So yeah, some good tools. Another good tool I want to mention is around AI voice cloning. It's called 11 Labs. You know, it is a fee-based service. It's not very expensive, but you do have to sign up and pay for the service.
That's really interesting, because I've heard of some scammers. Basically, the scam is they will try to impersonate someone you know.
Yeah.
Using something like 11 Labs and say, hey, mom, I need your help. I need money or whatever. And it's at times it's very convincing. I've heard also, I think, that there's CEO fraud scams using voice cloning, that type of thing. Have you ever done that yourself or had experience with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually had an engagement here recently where we did that. And the employees had gone through some pretty intensive training just on that attack itself, right? So they responded really well. They started asking kind of unique questions. And it reminds me of a real situation that happened to my father-in-law. He got a call. The person was pretending to be my son, so my father-in-law's grandson, and saying something about being stuck in Miami or something, and friend got arrested and he needs money and all that. My father-in-law, bless his heart, as we say in the South, he was a policeman for 30 years. And so, he's a little bit suspicious by nature anyway. And so he starts asking this person on the phone some details. He says, "What are the names of your two cats?" And the person just got a Fluffy, So I think the message there and the lesson there is learn to take a breath, especially if you get an urgent request, right? Mm-hmm. When we're faced with a situation and it's urgent, our adrenaline starts pumping, right? Mm-hmm. And it's natural, it's natural to do that. And to think quickly and to make quick decisions, because that's what urgency means, right? Make a quick decision. But realize it's probably not a life and death situation. And even if it were, the 3 seconds it takes to just take a breath and let that adrenaline kind of reduce down a little bit so you can think a little more clearly is going to save so much. And that 3 seconds is not going to really make a difference, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great lesson there.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And we've heard the term human firewall. A lot of the times when it comes down to social engineering, it comes down to the individual person, hopefully making a good decision and not being socially engineered. And you mentioned that company you had attempted the social engineering. They were very well trained against that specific attack, mm-hmm. which I found very interesting. Can you talk to us about potential mitigations, whether it's from a technology standpoint, training, or otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when it comes to broadly mitigating against the risk of social engineering, it really takes basically 3 components, right? And I kind of think of it as a 3-legged stool, right? First, you have the kind of technology and policy and procedure and the things that we can put in place organizationally that really don't even rely on the people so much. Right. Mm-hmm. It's just we construct this technological environment that limits what a person can do. Mm-hmm. Right. And then to kind of take care of the areas where we can't control and protect our employees, to take care of that gap, we use the other 2 stools, which is 1, training. We have to start with education. And a lot of times I'll say tech training and testing, but I sort of hate the word training. I don't remember the guy's name, but I was attending a talk one time and he was talking about employee education. He said, "I don't train people. I train dogs. I educate people." And there is a subtle difference there, right? Education reinforces concepts and philosophies, right? So that new situations can be encountered and you can be successful in new situations that you've never encountered before. Training is more by rote. So I'm big on education. I'm big on kind of in your face education, if you would. Mm-hmm. Give people examples. Tell them the why. Let them understand the why to everything and make it personal. And then, of course, you've got to do the testing. I love it when I get caught. I love it when people do the right thing and they follow procedures and I can't convince them to do something else. I mean, that's good. Yeah. That's a positive result. It makes me work harder sometimes because I try to find another way to figure out how to get them to do something that's against policy. But that's all the better because the attackers are not going to stop trying. They're going to continue to up their game. Right now, the barrier to entry to cybercrime is very low and the rewards are amazing. The attackers are not going to quit.
Let's move on to GRC and how can that help defend against social engineering?
There's 2 things that will essentially cut a social engineer off at the knees. 1 is the phrase, "I can't." When I'm on the phone with someone, in fact, yesterday, I was literally making a social engineering phone call, trying to get someone to change my password. And it wasn't that the person didn't want to help me, right? Mm. I could tell they wanted to help me, but they said, "I can't help you," right? I either don't have permissions or it's against policy and I literally just can't help you. I wish I could, but I can't. That stops a social engineer right in their tracks. That's the first thing. The second thing is, and this was really kind of weird. I was on a social engineering engagement one time. It was a physical, and I was supposed to walk into a retail establishment try to get access to the communications room, right? Where the servers are in the back and all that stuff. Pretty typical scenario. I walk up, and as soon as I start my initial, hey, I'm Chris, I'm from corporate IT, and I need to, before I even got my first sentence out of my mouth, the person that looked at me, she said, hold that thought. She picked up the phone and she dialed, I think, her manager or someone, and handed me the phone. And it just, I'm like, wow, okay, hey, this is Chris from, you know, all of a sudden, I've got to switch gears from face-to-face to on the phone, different person. I have no physical feedback signals. Mm-hmm. So involving a second person is an incredible strategy to knock a social engineer off his game. Now, you know, granted, I'm not a method actor. I'm not an improv person or something like that. So sure, there could be people who can handle that situation, but it just throws another barrier for the social engineer. So if you combine the I can't and you combine that with involving another person, you can really be effective against social engineering. So now, how does this relate to GRC, right? To actually answer your question, how's that? First and foremost, the I can't relates to the implementation of least privilege, right? If the help desk person doesn't have domain admin and they can't do everything under the sun in the system, then they just can't do it. So making sure they have least privilege. Also, and this actually relates to a specific CMMC requirement, it's separation of duties. If it requires two people to perform a function, then it's not very likely that a social engineer is going to be able to social engineer both parties to get that accomplished. Right. Mm-hmm. I was actually introduced to this very early on, even before my security career, when I worked at the Federal Reserve. I started in the wire transfer department, and we had what we called dual control, which is basically the same thing as separation of duties. There is literally a requirement of two individuals to perform a function. It's really interesting. When a wire transfer is sent through the Federal Reserve, it actually takes a total of four people to actually have the wire done. It's the person from the bank calling, the person who in the Federal Reserve who answers the phone, and then a second person at the Federal Reserve calls a fourth person or a different person at the bank. And so it takes literally four people for a wire transfer to be sent through that process. And the whole concept behind it is it protects you from fraud, and it also protects you from social engineering.
Right. That's fascinating. Yeah. Well, when we hear about GRC, governance, risk, and compliance, some people's next thought might be, okay, security controls. Give us an example of a CMMC security control that might help mitigate against social engineering.
This is my favorite part of CMMC. So Jacob, I don't know how soon you got involved with CMMC, but I'm coming up on 3 years. It was basically January of 2020 when I started learning about it and getting involved. I had the opportunity to participate in the provisional instructor program. So this was kind of train the trainer. The CMMCAB was hosting it. And part of that was to put together a video, a miniature session of how you would teach some of these concepts, right? So my favorite concepts or favorite practices within CMMC are typically in the media protection domain. I do a lot in physical social engineering with USB thumb drops and stuff like that. I love the miniaturization and the whole gadgetry of it. And so I put together this video, and you can go out on YouTube and I'm sure find it somewhere. Yeah. But basically, I did a demonstration on using a USB rubber ducky made by Hack5 and then related that to the different media protection domain practices. And the specific one that I think is really the kind of the linchpin that protects us from these type of attack is media protection 3.8.8. It's called shared media. It's prohibit the use of portable storage devices when such devices have no identifiable owner. Mm-hmm. And that's the key phrase there. They don't have an identifiable owner. So in other words, you find a thumb drive, and if nobody claims it, then you don't stick it in your computer, right? As much as I like CMMC, I'd love to see organizations treat this as a minimum requirement and then take it to that next level and say, not just the use of portable storage devices, but any portable media. whether it appears to be a storage device or not. Some portable media or removable media looks like this. Looks like a keyboard, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Looks like a mouse.
Yeah.
Right? But it might not be a mouse. It might not be a keyboard, right? It might actually be a portable storage device or some other device that's configured to attack your computer. So I think it's important for companies to understand really the intent of these practices and these requirements and the why. I go back to that from a security education standpoint, understand the why of why we have these protections.
It's very fascinating. And I had started at one point a USB security white paper, which unfortunately I never finished, but I did learn quite a bit about USB and the fact that, I mean, as you said, a keyboard could be a multifunction device and actually function as a network card as well or something like that. USB devices can actually function as anything. So very interesting. And then there's the threat also of the embedded firmware being overwritten or compromised when you plug it into a bad device because there's limited protections on most USB devices. YubiKey is one that has the firmware read-only, basically. But overall, USB security is not that great, as you said, which rolls right into penetration testing and talking about that. So can you talk to us about some of the interesting reasons why companies will hire pen testers?
I've been doing penetration testing for, again, 25 years. I mean, I got into that very quickly when I started in security. And at the Federal Reserve, the why, the objective of penetration testing was pretty obvious. We're protecting the nation's monetary system. And when you start thinking about it, the monetary system of the United States is all literally built on trust, okay? There's no more gold in Fort Knox behind our money, all right? It's, you know, little secret here. We're all just basing this currency on faith. It's a serious thing. If people lose faith in that system, in general, the whole banking system, then our economy crashes, our society crashes. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty easy to understand the reasoning behind penetration testing. When you get away from those environments, right? When you get out of the financial environment, or I mean, I worked at Home Depot for a while, even there with credit card data and all that stuff, it's pretty easy. When you get away from that and you get into the small business environment, really, you start coming up with situations where companies are not targets, right? They don't have this recognizability in the world, and they don't understand why they need to test their controls. So it's not always we need to protect our intellectual property. Not every small company has a bunch of intellectual property to protect, right? So it starts to become, okay, let's talk about business disruption. If you fall prey to a ransomware attack and someone takes away your ability to use your systems and now you can't recognize revenue, you're out of business. Okay, I understand that. What's the likelihood of that happening? Well, okay, it's pretty small because you have a really small digital footprint. And so the traditional risk management, whereas sometimes it does exist and certainly a concern, it's not always. And so sometimes it's, I'm trying to get cyber insurance and the cyber insurance company says, I got to have a pen test. Now, does that pen test have to look the same as someone who is trying to protect sensitive financial or sensitive state secrets? Well, no, it doesn't. I think as penetration testers, we need to be flexible and understand sometimes the objective is not, you know, super secret squirrel type stuff. The other thing I encounter a lot is people calling me and saying, I need a pen test. And I've tried to soften my language a little bit over time, but honestly, I come back to them and say, well, why do you think you need a pen test? Is somebody telling you you need a pen test or you've heard something that somewhere I'm concerned about security? Oh, you need a pen test because that doesn't really fit for everybody. In fact, in most cases, if someone is actually concerned about being attacked or losing business, honestly, a risk assessment would probably be a better first step, right? Let's go through an exercise and try to figure out where is your greatest risk? What are you most concerned about? And then what controls do you have on that? And what controls should you have on that, right? And then, of course, we measure the gap, the dreaded gap assessment, right? once we address that gap, that we think we've got a good solid set of controls, now let's go back and pen test them to measure how effective are the controls. But that's sort of toward the end of the game, not the first of the game.
I love that concept because as a pen tester, you're trying to find a path. And if you have a company who doesn't have any GRC in place whatsoever, it's like, okay, which 100 paths should I take here? And that's not very valuable to the company because it's like vulnerability scans. If it comes back with 10,000 findings, okay, which one do I start with? Right. They got to put in the work first. I really appreciate that point.
Yeah, I used to liken it to, I'm looking at your network through a straw. All I'm seeing is the one or two or five vulnerabilities that I need to get to domain admin. And once I've done that, most penetration testers don't back out and say, okay, I'm going to ignore that attack path and now see if I've got others. Because usually by the time you've done that and had your fun and taken your screenshots and maybe done whatever, shown some business impact, you take a breath, you feel like you're done. And I say this about auditors as well. We have to remember, pen testers are people too, right? And there's always the human element to everything. It's just people doing stuff.
Well, talk to us about OSINT CTF. What is that?
Back before I started my own business, I was doing presentations on social engineering and on open source intelligence. I mentioned that during the social engineering capture the flag contest, that phase one was OSINT. A lot of information you could pull just using OSINT. And it's amazing. I mean, it's a whole world. And nowadays, it gets blended with threat intelligence and everything. And I was doing a presentation, and my boss at the time was kind enough to let me use him as kind of a volunteer victim, I guess. And so I did a lot of research on him. And it turned out that I found a little glitch, I guess, in Facebook where I was able to get pictures of his children and information about them, what their birthdays were and all this stuff. And I was given this presentation and people were just like shocked. I mean, they were just amazed at how much information and how much sensitive information could be pulled from social media and that type of thing. So this was back in probably 2011, 2012. So I got to thinking about it. I ended up turning it into kind of a webinar and a class. And I had a friend of mine who worked with foster children, and he thought, man, this is so applicable to foster parents because it's very important when you take in a foster child that their original parents, because usually they come from some abusive environment or something like that, are not able to track them down. Right. So you have to be very careful what information you post out there online about this foster child. He was very passionate about it. And so he and I got together and we started doing these classes. And what we would do is we would set up the scenario of, we would kind of teach people these processes of discovering information online. And then we would have an exercise where it was kind of hack yourself, like find out what is out there about you that someone without logging in to your Facebook could find out. And it was really eye-opening, and it really, it kind of turned into people, parents, ending up finding out what their kids had posted online. That's what it became, right? It became a parenting thing, right?
Yeah.
So we started going off with that, and then it became, this is really like just literally the practice of performing the OSINT is actually fun. It's very educational, and it's actually kind of fun to do, right? And so what we decided to do, we decided to create this competition in 2015. We first did it at B-Sides Atlanta, thanks to those guys, the organizers, for letting us do a trial run there. And it just turned into a thing. And so ever since 2015, the contest has evolved over time. But essentially what we do is we have voluntargets. So there are real people who volunteer to let our contestants stalk them online, essentially. But we try to make sure that we control it really well so that no one is embarrassed. It's not meant to be malicious or anything like that. We set up the actual flags to be things that are approved by the voluntarget, right? So they literally get to review the possible flags and they get to tell us what they're comfortable with the contestants finding out. We've done this contest, like I say, for 8 years now at different conferences. We did it at DerbyCon a couple years. We've done it at CypherCon, GERCon, NOLACon. We did it at HackRedCon at their inaugural event a couple of years ago. So it's a lot of fun and we're working on some enhancements. You should definitely look for it at conferences coming up this year. I'm really excited about it. We typically give out really good prizes like drones and Flipper Zeros and all the fun stuff. It's a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, awesome. I love that origin story too. That's great. That's really good. Well, Chris, this has really been amazing. I really appreciated the insights you've shared. Thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you?
Absolutely, Jacob. It's been a lot of fun this morning as well. So basically, people, if you just go out to the internet and yell CG Silvers on pretty much any platform, it'll probably be me, right? First and foremost, my website is cgsilver.com, and that's Silvers, right? No hiding there. I'm CG Silvers on Twitter, on LinkedIn. It's CG, literally LinkedIn/IN/CG Silvers. I do have a monthly newsletter. I try to keep it nice and brief, but it's like the last Tuesday of every month that comes out and just interesting articles and keep up with where we're headed conference-wise, where I speak at conferences and things like that.
Well, thanks again for coming on. Really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jacob.